This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. Kate, we have a few new Patreons. I find that word really hard to say.
They're our patrons via Patreon, so it makes it even more hard and difficult, but nevertheless, it's truly exciting.
It is. And so just to give them a shout out, thank you to Sonia Plitt, Sally Piper, Miranda Luby, and Mandy Mercury. We really appreciate your support.
People are so lovely and nice.
I know. It's good. It's fabulous. We obviously don't make any money. The money that we pull in through Patreon goes to paying Phoebe to do all our editing and production.
And making us sound better, which she does so well.
Okay, let's talk about podcasts. I've been listening to them obsessively at the moment because I'm doing more driving. I never thought.
Which is so strange because everyone else we're hearing from is saying, oh my gosh, I'm so far behind on podcasts because I haven't got enough driving commuting time.
Well, I think the way that I'm lucky is that the job that I'm working on for work, and I'm not out there I'm out there maybe once or twice, once a week or every second week, is about an hour and a half from home. So that's like 3 hours of
that is so good. Time. You can smash through them.
Exactly. And I'm also doing running instead of Pilates, and running means podcasts.
Like when you say running, like how
that's
running?
A stretch. Like, it's probably a stretch. Interval training.
How long for? You don't half have to say distance or speed. Half an hour.
Half an hour. Okay. Yeah, half an hour. 35 minutes sometimes. I can't remember if I mentioned this. I did with the kids, we were doing the couch to 5K with Tilly and Oscar.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It was such a good one. They're 4 and 6.
So hang on, they can run 5K.
Well, we probably stopped at about the 3K mark, but I reckon they could have got there.
That's amazing.
It's really amazing. Surprising what they could do. I mean, sometimes they complain. Generally, one would complain and the other would not complain in a pointed, I'm the better child kind of way. Nice. Yeah.
So much to unpack there. That's a whole episode in itself, the way that our children complain and what they're doing as they do it. Okay, so you're running and you're driving a long way. What are you listening to?
Obsessively listening to Chernobyl, the podcast. Have you heard of this one?
You have mentioned it to me before. Tell us about it.
God. So Chernobyl is the nuclear power plant that was in Ukraine.
Yeah.
We're not saying the Ukraine, are we? It's Ukraine. I always want to say the, but anyway. Ironically, during a routine safety check, basically the nuclear power plant exploded.
That's right.
And it was like a terrible, terrible accident, made very much worse by the fact the Russian government basically denied that it happened. And so you had all these Russian people, Ukrainian people wandering around in the streets while nuclear radioactive air is, shocking, but a fascinating thing to be studying. And so the Chernobyl series is a TV show and the Chernobyl podcast is a podcast that unpacks the TV series, which I haven't actually seen.
So not by the makers of the TV series, like by someone else?
By a third party. No. So the makers are obviously very involved and you have lots of interviews with the actors and with the people that wrote it. Just the most... It's that, which I think there's a bit of a trend towards at the moment, that real dissecting of minutiae. Yeah. Like each episode of the podcast is based on the podcast episodes are probably 40 minutes, which is the same length as the TV show. So you're sort of really, really good. Highly recommend.
Excellent. Okay. I'm adding it to my list. I am not getting as much time on podcasts as I normally would. But I have decided that my post-isolation, post-no-gym, post-sourdough eating kind of
sourdough
exercise.
Starter? Are you making?
No, I tried just eating, once. Eating got one sourdough. From Ava. Absolutely. Gracie just said, this is not good, basically. And why all this effort for this. So we ditched that, but I ate a lot of other people's very fine sourdough. So getting back on the walking bandwagon, I have been putting my earpods in my ears. So I have just started, and this is a very new one, but I'm already four episodes in, listening to Debutante, which is the new podcast from Miranda Tapsell and Nahia Louie, through Audible. So you have to listen to it through Audible.
So do you have an Audible subscription? Is that how that works?
It's like a prescription sometimes. I do, but I'm pretty sure, because I saw when they were talking about it, I'm pretty sure you can get a link, listen to this podcast for free. So check that out. If we can, we'll put a link into it. It is so good. So it's the framework is that it's about the kind of history of debutante balls and debutante balls in Australia, and in particular in the Aboriginal community. Nahia Louie supports her mum to kind of run this big one in Sydney.
Oh my God, fascinating.
But it's also like a look at colonisation and race and beauty and power, and it is fascinating. It is entertaining. It is laugh out loud funny in parts, and then it does that like sucker punch of then just being completely devastating and giving you, laying out the facts of, you know, stolen generation or white privilege or various other things. So I just, yeah, it's amazing. Obviously, in terms of the timing of when it's come out, and I know that that is not planned because it's obviously been a long time in the making. It's just...
Yeah, it's perfect timing, isn't it?
It's perfect timing. And for people who are doing that kind of, okay, I'm going to dig down and I'm going to do the listening and learning and look at my privilege, etc., you know, it already got me kind of examining my own stuff about my own feelings about debutante balls and how...
Did you do a deb?
No.
Have you ever been to one?
No. Because I was completely anti. I was invited to one and I didn't go because I was like, you know, on my high horse about, you know, the gender and all the rest of it. But looking at that from this different angle now and seeing what that is. And the other thing, and this is something for us to go into deeply later, the thing about advocating niceness, which I have sometimes done, and being agreeable as a way of navigating our industry and all those kinds of things, and talk about this specifically, like what a privileged position that is to be advocating that. Yeah. So all that kind of stuff that, you know, it's kind of one of those ones that makes you think. Very slick, very compelling, highly recommend it.
Oh, I'm very excited about that.
Yes, I know. So your next one
is a specific episode of the Good One podcast, which I have talked about before, but this one is with Hannah Gadsby. Who did Nanette. And so she basically unpacks a lot behind Nanette. She comes across as quite prickly, actually, on the back of a discussion about niceness.
Yeah.
Really good. One of the cool things is, I think I've talked to you before about that, this comedy thing that's quite common called the callback.
Yes.
So you'll make a joke early on and you might get a few laughs with it, but then later on you refer to it again, and it's something that audiences really like and is a sort of a common technique. And so she talks about the callback in Nanette, but breaks it down to, rather than use the callback for humour, she would make that initial joke and then use the callback in a completely different context that is the stabby, like the...
Oh, yeah.
It's a really fascinating... I've never heard anyone describe in such detail around why it works, but now I remember watching Nanette. It was totally like that. Like, she would make a joke and you would move on and start talking about something else, and then she would go, I'll remember that. Well, actually, this is... Like, it's such an interesting technique. Anyway.
That's so clever, and also shows how much you are into what you describe as this thing that everyone's doing at the moment, which is that really granular examination of
how
things are done.
I'm very excited to do it for your book. I cannot wait.
I don't know how I'm feeling now about this level of
Well, it's more questions. It was actually listening to the Chernobyl podcast, even some of the stuff around research and why they made, you know, some decisions around story and shorthands, but just paralleling... Particularly if it's in the context of Chernobyl, it's real. Paralleling what happened in the TV show and then getting to explore some of the history of that actually being true. Like, they had this one bit where there's radioactive stuff spilling into the air, and the issue with radioactive stuff or how it affects you is how close you are to it, how much, how long you're close to it and how strong it is or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, in order to cover up the radioactive stuff, they basically just got in teams and teams of people, and their job, they needed to sort of basically shovel dirt and put it on top of it. But because it was so strong, each individual person could only stand where they had to stand to shovel one shovelful of dirt on top. So you have, and they just had interviews with people who had, yeah, just phenomenal stories about this really bizarre thing. And Russia, very, very strange place at that time anyway. Yeah.
I wonder if it will become a real thing to have like this accompanying kind of podcast or to sit next to your
Well, it's interesting because I've never
your book or your...
I haven't watched the show. Like, so it's like it exists it's still beyond. It's utterly accessible. Compelling. You know it's compelling when you're listening to a podcast in bed, I reckon, rather than reading.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
that's all like right. you're, next level.
You are deep in. Yeah. You are deep in. I have gone deep into my next one, which is the New York Times rabbit hole. Have you started listening to that yet? I think you will like this. So, again, I'm only 4 episodes in. It is so compelling and terrifying. It's basically following a guy.
I've heard of this now that you say it. Yep.
Yeah, down his YouTube rabbit hole into how he became kind of fell into the alt-right world and then back out again and then back in again. So looking at like YouTube and the algorithms, it's just, it's frightening. It's so interesting to listen to. One of the frightening things about it is that, like, I've never heard an alt-right YouTuber. That is not within my filter bubble. Ever. So this is the first time that I'm hearing some of the stuff that they say in the opinions, etc. So that's kind of shocking, I suppose. But also that same level of like deep analysis of how this got to be, how the systems are set up so that this has happened. So interesting. Really, really interesting.
I can't remember where I heard about that, but it is a fascinating premise, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sneaking in an extra third that is not a podcast. It is a book, but I have listened to it in my ears, I promise you.
I will allow this.
The reason I'm sneaking in is because I did listen to it in bed, which gives an indication of how into it I was. So Station 11, the book by Emily St. John Mandel, which has just had this huge rise back in the chart. So it's 2014 book, but it's about a pandemic. It's just like sold a bazillion more copies. She's got a new book out at the moment as well. And the reason that I did it, if my PR director is listening from Simon & Schuster, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but people had been saying to me, oh, so is it kind of like Station 11? I would never... go as far to say my book is anywhere near as good as Emily St. John Mandel's, but I was finally in a position where I had to like, I've got to read this book.
Yes, to be able to.
About, to be able to talk about it. It is so good. So it's the day the pandemic, the Georgia flu kind of arrives in New York, and then it jumps forward because society collapses within 3 weeks because it's got a 99 point whatever percent of efficiency in killing people. I don't think that's the right term, but so it goes forward and back and it's incredible. And then the meta experience of reading it during a pandemic, obviously even more than that, but it's also beautifully produced. So, you know, when you get an audiobook that's like, oh, this is a slick production.
Yeah.
It really is a slick production. So I,
so when you say that, so Malcolm Gladwell has done, he's got the Conversations with Strangers book, and I think his Audible production compiles the actual voices of interviewees and that sort of thing. Is it like that? Like, is it got a theatrical element to it, or it's just very nicely?
No, it's very nicely. It's only one actor, sound artist, but I don't know what you call them, voice artist, but he does quite a range of accents and he's very accomplished at them. So there's that.
That can go very wrong.
It can go very wrong, but in this situation it goes... Yeah, it goes very right. So, I highly recommend that one as
nice
well.
Nice one. this isn't my one, but have you been hearing a lot about American Dirt?
Oh, my goodness.
What? Have you read it? Is it nonfiction? Is it fiction? I just keep... Oh, I feel like I've had five people say the name of the book American Dirt to me in the last
couple of days. There'll be a whole lot of people who are like, you did not tell that story right, Kate. So we'll put in some links to the American Dirt story. The thing with American Dirt is that it sold, I think, for a couple of million dollars maybe in the US.
Oh, wow.
She got that. That was her advance. The controversy around American Dirt is that it is written about a woman fleeing Mexico, and that the woman who has written it is not Mexican. So it's an own voices kind of controversy. Oh. And basically when it blew up, the publisher ended up cancelling her American tour. But what's really interesting is that I was just involved in a Twitter conversation yesterday about the fact that it's still number one on Goodreads. So whether the idea of cancelling a book in the literary world actually...
That's an interesting point.
To any kind of counselling in the bookstores or in the reading world. So Jane Rawson, Sarah Schmidt, Bram Presser, you are on notice here that Catherine just raised that, and she didn't even know that you want to get on an episode and talk about
cool.
Cancelled. So now we can properly do that.
It is a way. I guess it is a way. Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. I look forward to that.
Yeah.
My other exciting podcast is Slow Burn, second season specifically, which is all about the Monica Lewinsky, I've written Bill Gates, what's his name? Bill Clinton, impeachment process. Really fascinating. Fascinating because it's obviously in our memory. I think we were in high school, latter half of high school probably. Also something that actually, although what happened to Monica Lewinsky was appalling, I feel like it wouldn't happen now. Like I do feel hopeful about things have changed somewhat.
Yeah, I would.
Although now I'm thinking about Trump.
I know. Maybe some things have changed for the better.
Maybe.
Some things most definitely have not. And on that hopeful note, we shall leave you.
Laura McPhee Brown is a writer, social worker and counsellor living in Melbourne on Wurundjeri land. Her writing has appeared in publications such as Mianjin, The Saturday Paper, Island, Overland and Kill Your Darlings. She was highly commended in both the Rachel Fenari Prize for Fiction 2016 and the Hope Prize 2016. Laura McPhee Brown, let's start at the very start. Did you always want to write?
Not really. I didn't always, I guess I sort of just didn't really consider that I would be able to, so I just didn't really think about it. I wrote, when I was really little, I wrote short, like little, made little books that I would do the illustrations for of some characters called The Shapes, but my mum and dad still have those books. So that was when I was really little, but then I didn't write really anything for a long time, and I just read a lot, and then... Yeah, I was going out with a guy about 7 or 8 years ago who was a writer, and then I moved in with someone who was a writer, and I thought, oh, maybe I'll give it a go, and I really liked it. So,
oh, wow. And how long ago was that?
Well, that was probably when I was about 29, so, yeah, it's like nearly 7 years ago, yeah.
And can you remember or tell us about the first time you saw your work in print?
Yeah, well, I was trying to think about that. Online, published online, I had a short story published in an American online magazine. That was my first story, and it was a really short story, really weird little story that I wrote. And that was amazing. I was so excited. And looking back now, it's such a weird story. But yeah, it was really cool at the time. Very impressed with myself.
And did you work, was that sort of short stories? Was that your thing for a while? Is that where you started out?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I started out trying to write a bit of poetry, but like I did not know what I was doing. So then I thought, oh, maybe I'll try a short story. And that was really fun. I loved doing that. So I've written a lot of short stories, and that was definitely how I started out. I'm still writing them now. I really love writing them. So.
And so is Cherry Beach the first novel-length manuscript you ever wrote?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And what was the seed? Where did it all begin?
Well, I wanted to write. So I lived in Toronto for a couple of years from age of 29 to 31. So I wanted to write about Toronto. I just kind of missed it and wanted to write something maybe that there. And then kind of wanted to write a queer character. And then it just sort of started to happen, and it wasn't anything like what I sort of thought it was going to be. So, and then as I was going, I sort of really became clear on what it was becoming and started planning what it became, but it didn't start out that way.
So would you say you're a pantser then? You just sort of start and see where the writing takes you?
Usually, Yeah, but sometimes I do have quite a clear idea, but it doesn't, having said that, I think when I have a clear idea, I usually end up changing it. Like it just doesn't seem to work when I try to plan. Yeah.
The structure of Cherry Beach is very interesting because it's obviously a novel and it has a sort of single story, I suppose you'd say. But it, in some ways it's like many, many short stories that kind of, does that sound true to you, or is that very different from how you would see it? I felt like they were sort of succinct chunks in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I haven't thought about it that way, but that would probably make sense because I don't often write a lot in one go, so I would have never written more than one chapter in one day. And I think, so I probably would have really focused on just one chapter at a time, really kind of, so that would make sense that it feels kind of, you know, a little tiny thing within a bigger thing. Mm. Yeah, I haven't thought about that. I suppose also because the chapters have names.
They do. I'm interested in how you, did you have an approach for naming? Was naming difficult?
Well, I just decided I wanted to, it's funny, I don't remember all the why I did what I did, but I did just start Googling the names of bodies of water because I started to see that there were so many beautiful words to describe types of water and something to do with water. So I just started to look around and try and find all the words and words about water that were something to do with water. And then I started to see that often the dictionary definition was quite poetic. Like it was almost, you could sort of copy and paste a bit of it and it sounded like a tiny little poem, even though it was just something out of, you know, Macmillan or something. So I played around with that a bit. But, yeah, just because I think there's a lot of themes of water in the book and I just kind of, just seemed to work.
And did that theme...
Yeah.
Did that emerge early on, the water sort of metaphor that, as you say, runs throughout the story?
Yeah, I think part of why I wanted to write about Toronto is because I've said this before when I've spoken to people, but I really was kind of obsessed with Lake Ontario when I went there. I just thought it was really interesting. I'd never seen such a big lake. Like it's just so different in Victoria. The bodies of water that I'd known well were like the ocean or like a dam or a river, not so much a lake for me anyway. And it just seemed to me that it was the ocean. Like I couldn't believe, because you just can't see the other side. It's so big. And it just seemed like it was the ocean to me. So I just wanted a character in the book to be in some way, you know, to think that way as well. But then it became that Hetty was sort of very preoccupied by that, that idea. I wanted it to be a bit about that, and then it just grew from there that she really loved water and
And how did it go from being a manuscript sitting on your computer to a book on the shelf?
Yes, I still can't really understand how. Well, it was all really my editor, David, at Text. Like, he really, really knows what he's doing, and he really just helped me I mean, he helped me with the manuscript on my computer a lot, and then
how did it get in his yeah. hands? Was that
I was lucky because I had been writing short stories for a while and had had quite a few published around Australia. So what happened was that one of the publicists at Text actually had read a few of my stories, looked on my website and saw that I had written there that I was writing a novel. And at that stage, I really wasn't really writing, like I was barely writing a novel. I just wrote it on there. But I'm glad I did, because then she contacted me. She showed some of my stories to David, and they contacted me and said, can we please read a bit of the novel?
Oh, my God, this is like a dream.
I know. It's really bizarre because truly, like, texts were my – when I thought maybe I'll write a book or maybe I'll have a collection of stories published, I wanted it to be text. Like, they were my dream publisher. So it was just amazing, really. I couldn't actually believe it. I still can't really believe it. Yeah, and then we met together, and then I started having to really work on the novel. And then I wrote kind of basically a very draft manuscript. Oh, no. I sent them a section, and they said, yes, we want to read the whole thing when you have the whole thing. And then I wrote the whole thing, and then they read it, and then they offered me publication with obviously some work on it.
And so what was the time period for that? How long did it take from the point at which they first contacted to having finished writing a draft?
It wasn't that long, because I do rush things. After that there was quite a lot of work that needed to be done on it. I don't know exactly, but I think it was around 9 or 10 months.
That's pretty good. It's impressive. That's like a huge effort to get it done so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, it did need some work. But, that's one good thing is that I do things quickly if I put my mind to it. Yeah.
And so the book came out in February of this year. Yeah. Walk us through publication day. What did that look like?
Publication day was the day before my launch. So I was really bit nervous about my launch, and I wasn't actually that well in my mental health at the time, so I didn't actually do that much on my publication. It's fine, but just had a bit of a quiet day, and I don't think I was working at my other job, and I didn't feel like writing, so I just didn't do very much. And my partner and I had planned to go to readings and see it on the shelf, but we actually didn't go. So I didn't see it until I was at my launch, and I was running late, and I got there and had to make my speech, and I saw it on the shelf as I was making the speech. So yeah, that was a bit funny. But
and so all that happened really right before COVID hit. It must feel like there's a bit of a pre-COVID and post-COVID. What were the weeks that followed the launch like? Before COVID took hold.
Yeah. I had had like a couple of things. I did like the Kill Your Darlings book club, and I did a couple of radio interviews, and it was a bit of a whirlwind, of things, just kind of writing a few things as well, and planning things with my publicist, who's wonderful. And then I actually went overseas, which was...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I had close friends getting married in Poland.
Oh, my God.
So we went to Poland, and then we went to Copenhagen, and then we went to Athens. And
oh, my God.
It's actually really bizarre, because on the way back from Athens, our flight from wherever we stopped over to Melbourne, someone had coronavirus on our flight. So we found this out a few days after we landed, and then we were basically in isolation.
Isolation?
Yeah, we went into isolation, and then the rest of Australia went into full isolation almost as soon as we were able to come out of it. Yeah,
wow.
But everyone else. Yeah, and most people. Yeah.
Wow.
We were lucky because we just missed the quarantine of when you would have to go to a hotel. Like, it was only, I think, 6 days after we landed or 7 days that they decided that you can't go straight home. So very lucky. Yeah.
Gosh, what strange times.
It is. And I feel so bad. So many people have had to cancel their trips and we squeezed ours in. But, yeah.
And what about the life of the book under COVID and restrictions? Have you had to do a lot of stuff online?
Well, I haven't actually had that much that I've had to do. Like, I haven't... I have done a couple of things, yeah, but it's been not too... Like, some people have had a lot of things cancelled. I haven't had too many things, so that's been okay, yeah.
It always feels a bit reductive to talk about covers of books, but the cover of Cherry Beach is so beautiful. It's very hard not to comment on it. What did you think when you saw it? Had you had input or was it a surprise?
Yeah, well, I was, like, so happy when I saw it. I think I actually cried. Oh, and I'm pretty sorry if you cried. Of happiness, not sadness. But, it was a bit of a process because we had Imogen, who did the cover. She's really wonderful, and it had various kind of there'd been a few different versions that were going to be the cover before this one, even though I think this one's perfect and glad it all happened. So I'd known a bit about what was happening with those other versions, and at the beginning I was a bit nervous about it, having, you know, I wanted to have input on the cover. But
did you have a vision, or you just wanted to be able to
I sort of hoped it would be a certain way, and it's actually very similar to what I would have hoped. I sent a few examples of books I like, but really, like, a text that's like, it's really very okay to just really just stand back and, you know, they know what they're doing, absolutely. Yeah. So I really didn't need to worry at all.
It's interesting you mentioned writing poetry prior to writing Cherry Beach. The writing of the book is so beautifully poetic. But also, and I mean this as a really big compliment, it's really easy to read at the same time. As a reader, I was swept along, but as a writer, I wanted to sort of dissect every sentence. Mm-hmm. One of the things that really strikes you reading it is the sense of the mood, that feeling of being in your 20s, the melancholy, the love, the freedom. Do you think about mood when you're writing?
I don't think about it as in, like, consciously, like, right, this is the mood that I want, but I really picture it in my mind, and I think it becomes a bit bodily, and then I sort of just go with that. Like, I think my partner said to me when he's watching me write sometimes, like, I'm in a trance. Like, it's quite, I mean, not completely, but, like, I just really don't, like, I'm just in it, and so I guess that's what must have happened, and because I can picture everything so clearly and smell it and sort of taste it and everything, so that, because so I don't know how to really answer that well,
One of the things that really looms large in Cherry Beach is mental health, and you have a background working in counselling and in social work. How has your work influenced your writing, or has your work influenced your writing?
I think it definitely has. And I grew up with mental illness in my family, and I've had my own sort of issues with it, but certainly around, I guess, psychosis and mania and things like that. In my first job as a social worker, I worked in homelessness and in a couple of programs around people with serious mental illness or drug dependency. And that's just, that was like a huge time for me, just learning so much and seeing the different ways that people experience the world and, I guess, suffer, but also...
sort of a sense of beauty at the same... There's like a suffering and a beautifulness. That's, I mean, if you think of the character of Hetty.
Yeah, it's hard to say it without it sounding really kind of twee or, you know, a bit silly, but, yeah, it was really, even now thinking back to the people I worked with, I feel incredibly privileged that I was able to kind of just be there. And I think the skill that time has affected my work, my writing, absolutely. Yeah. Mm.
And so what does writing and work life look at like at the moment? Are you doing a bit of both, or do you have to squeeze writing in around work?
No, I'm pretty lucky. I work 3 days a week in my non-writing. So I have 2 days to write, and really, like, I'm not the biggest person for routine. So I think, you know, some days I might write on the weekend and then have a weekday off, or like it's sort of, I can be really flexible, and my shift hours at my other work are not always 9 to 5. So it's actually quite good too. Yeah.
And are you working on something at the moment?
Yeah, I'm working on like just a few short stories, just because I like to do them every now and then. And then a new novel, but it's very...
You're going to put it on your bio?
Yeah, I should. I actually just replied to a tweet today saying what it was about. So I put it out there. I haven't really put it out there because I didn't want it to jinx it or something, but yeah, hopefully it's going to be a thing one day.
Yeah. Has Corona had an impact on your ability to write? Have you found it?
Yeah, well, not so much now, but the first couple of weeks I didn't write anything. I was quite grumpy about everything. I just was grumpy and tired, and then I had just no motivation, and yet the littlest things seem to take all your energy. It's been quite interesting, but I'm getting back into it now, and I just have to, you know, really make myself just have a bit more routine around it, because I find that once I'm in it and I'm doing it every couple of days, I really want to do it. But obviously, yeah, once I stop, I just don't.
It's easy to fall out of the habit.
Doing it again. Yeah.
All right. Final question. What advice do you have for other debut authors?
Well, as I said, I was quite lucky that I'd had sort of writing already out there in the world. I think if you want to and you can, work on little things that you can get out there as well as your big projects, and that can be nice for variety. And just, you know, the more writing you do, the better your writing will be, I think. And if you think that you're a good writer, if you think that you have something, like, go for it. Like, don't sort of feel like you shouldn't think that you have something to say, and just support that within you, that belief, because that's kind of, that will keep you going. Mm. You know, there's going to be so much self-doubt, and I think a lot of writers, the mood of, or the way we see ourselves is so up and down, and, you know, one minute you're like, I'm so fantastic, and next minute you're just like, what am I doing? This is appalling. But, you know, you just need both those things, so it's okay to feel really good about yourself sometimes, because you will feel bad about your writing again, I'm sure, at some point.
So, I think that's great advice. Thank you. I realise I do have one more question. Laura McPhee-Brown, what's your favourite novel by a debut author?
Well, I don't know what my favourite one is, but one that I read recently that I thought was amazing was that isn't out yet, but it will be out, I believe, in August, is A Room Called Earth by Madeline Ryan. It's a book coming out with Scribe, and I won't say too much, but it is written from the inside the head of a young woman with autism, although that's never really said, never kind of put out there, but it's incredible. I've never read anything like it, and I was really in awe of Madeline's writing. And I was lucky enough to write a quote for it, so I got to read an early copy, and yeah, really recommend it.
Ooh, I've written that down. I'm excited to
read it. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
Oh, nice one. Laura McPhee-Brown, the first time quick five, and you can pass on any question. For your first time, agent or no agent?
No agent.
Advance or no advance?
Yes, $5,000 advance.
Published in Australia, New Zealand only, or overseas territories as well?
Australian, Indian, and New Zealand only.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
I don't have any at this point, no.
And number of copies sold?
I have no idea.
Yeah. I wouldn't expect you would.
No.
Oh, that's great. And that's it.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.